Welcome to Chiropractic Science, where you get to hear interviews with leading chiropractic researchers from around the world. My name is Dr. Dean Smith, and I am the host of Chiropractic Science. I am a clinical professor in the Department of Kinesiology and Health at Miami University, and I'm also a chiropractor in Eaton, Ohio. My research interests relate to understanding how chiropractic affects motor control and human performance. Today, I have the privilege of interviewing Dr. Felipe Duarte. But before we get to the interview, I want to thank all of you who have subscribed to Chiropractic Science, and I'm especially appreciative to all of you who have contributed five-star reviews on iTunes. iTunes reviews, Spotify reviews, and all these other podcasting app reviews, they do help others find out about chiropractic and chiropractic science. So if you like the show, please take a second and write a review. It will support chiropractors everywhere. Before we get to this episode of Chiropractic Science, I wanted to let you know about Clinical Compass. I am pleased to let you know that I've recently been appointed to their scientific commission, and I wanted to give you an update about their activities. Many chiropractors probably have heard about Clinical Compass, which is a 501c3 nonprofit, apolitical evidence synthesis think tank. They conduct a variety of systematic literature reviews, develop best practice recommendations. They maintain a resource evidence center that highlights research relevant to chiropractic stakeholders, and they provide rapid response letters to the editor. The Clinical Compass has published some incredible research, including best practices and clinical guidelines, along with systematic reviews. Some of the topics include the cost of chiropractic versus medical management of adults with spine-related musculoskeletal pain, a systematic review. And you can listen to episode 66 of the Chiropractic Science Podcast with Dr. Farabaugh to hear about that very important study for our profession. Others include clinical practice guidelines for best practice management of pediatric patients by chiropractors. That was a Delphi consensus study. Best practices for adult patients with low back pain and development of preliminary integrated healthcare clinical competencies for United States Doctor of Chiropractic programs. These are just some of the significant works that Clinical Compass has published recently. I'll put a link in this episode's show notes so you can visit the Clinical Compass website. There you can also make a donation to support chiropractic research and to help get this information out to payers, business leaders, legislators, and the general public. All donations to Clinical Compass are 100% tax deductible, and I, by the way, don't get any of that money because, you guessed it, I'm a volunteer for this great organization. Well, let's get on to the interview with Dr. Felipe Duarte. Dr. Felipe Duarte graduated from FEVAL University, Brazil in 2008. He has clinical experience as a chiropractor and three other degrees in exercise physiology, human physiology, and his PhD in neuroscience. Between 2019 and 2023, he held a research intensive position at CMCC in Toronto as a postdoctoral fellow and research associate in a rehab research-focused hospital, that was KITE, in Toronto. Since 2023, Felipe is a senior lecturer at the School of Health, Medical, and Applied Sciences Chiropractic Discipline at Central Queensland University in Australia. He also holds adjunct professor status at the Canadian Memorial Chiropractic College. His research interests aim to 1. Investigate the neurobiological and neuromechanical mechanisms underlying highly prevalent disabling chronic musculoskeletal conditions such as chronic spine pain, neuropathic pain, fibromyalgia, myofascial pain syndrome, and osteoarthritis, which are a great concern to public health systems. 2. To investigate the underlying mechanisms of rehab strategies such as force-based mechanotherapy, such as spinal manipulation, focusing on the neurobiological and neuroimmune factors, and 3, using these biological determinants to explore their potential for patient stratification in chronic musculoskeletal conditions and spinal manipulation, for example, discovering responders versus non-responders in these studies. Felipe has experience in various methodologies and study designs to address his research interests, which range from molecular biology to neuroimaging and clinical epidemiology. Felipe also possesses direct teaching experience in biochemistry, physiology, neuromusculoskeletal anatomy, neuroanatomy, and clinical neurological assessment and diagnosis, both at the undergraduate and postgraduate levels. Well, Dr. Duart, thanks so much for coming on the Chiropractic Science Podcast.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Dean, for inviting me. It's a great pleasure being here.
For sure. Well, I've wanted to have you on for some time, so I appreciate you coming on. Why don't we get started with one of my favorite questions of the podcast, which is just simply, how did you become interested in becoming a chiropractor?
Sure. Classic question. Thank you very much, first of all, yeah, for having me here. So it's a kind of a classic story. So everybody that I've listened from this podcast kind of follow the same pathway. So a previous experience with a chiropractor, something like that. So in my case was like my mom, she suffered from chronic low back pain and sciatic as well. And so obviously she tried several treatments, managements at that time. So it was around, let's say, early 2000s. And obviously nothing really worked well. And she ended up finding like a recommendation for going to a chiropractor. And at that time, just to bring a little bit of a context here. So I was in Brazil at that time, and chiropractic, it wasn't very popular as like a treatment, as a, like a kind of a, was more like in a sideline in terms of a light health treatment. So it was kind of hard finding a chiropractor, but we were recommended to go to a chiropractor, and obviously the treatment and the management worked very well. And I was usually going with her, and I became interested, like I start asking questions to the chiro, and in terms of where did you graduate, or how does these things work, and all that sort of like context. And this is how I kind of, it drove me to this passion. And obviously Google wasn't and AI wasn't very popular at that time, but I was trying to understand what chiropractic was or is, and so on. So luckily, we had, at that time, Fevale University was opening up a chiropractic program in Brazil, and I ended up getting registered myself over there, and this is just history right now. Yeah.
That's great. It's interesting that you went and you started because of your mom. I think a lot of people do that with various family members. I know my brother, he got chiropractic care at the same time as me. And so, yeah, it's interesting how many of us have that sort of family connection to it as well.
Yeah, 100%. Or it's a personal connection, like finding a treatment for themselves or like a family member. So it's definitely quite inspiring. And I think it works very well for our profession. I think everybody kind of have these things in common.
For sure. Well, yeah. Tell us, so you went through school there, and I'm assuming you went into private practice right after that, or how did things go for you?
Yeah, that's correct. So, I wasn't too much into research while I was in doing my program. Obviously, everybody, when you get into the chiro school, you want to become a clinician and you want to help the others and so on. But I ended up getting in touch with research because of one of my mentors over there. I had this thing with me. I like asking questions. So kind of every single class, I was asking questions and more questions and more questions. And this teacher of mine kind of mentioned, Felipe, I think it would be a good fit in research. And I said, oh, I don't know. I never thought about that. So during my fourth and fifth year, so we have like a research kind of a thesis, sort of a research unit or a research course that it is like a 2 years course or 2 years. Yeah, so these units like go through 2 years, and you go through all like steps in research. So you go, you apply to ethics, and you end up doing some data collection, or you do like a literature synthesis, whatever your project is about, you end up doing. And at that time, I was into more like a in more like a qualitative sort of research. So I did my research project aiming to understand the role or the perception and satisfaction of patients and also other healthcare practitioners in a public health system where like the chiropractors, or I was doing some part of my internship. And I think the answers were very nice. And was pretty positive feedback from patients and also from other healthcare practitioners, like dentists, nurses, and medical doctors, and so on. But one of the feedback that I got from everybody was like, first was about the safety of the manipulation, especially around the neck. And the other feedback was about the mechanism. So how does chiro treatment work? So thinking like more like the chiro, not too much about the chiropractic care at that time, but thinking more like about a manipulation itself. Okay. So I think they brought a lot of these questions and they would like to understand a bit more. And that kind of sticked with me. So that sort of question. So once I finished my program, I became chiropractor and in practice for 2-3 years, like in full time. In a private practice, but that kind of thing stick with me, especially because like patients were coming into your office and you do a good job. So you treat the patients very, very well and you get like nice response in terms of outcomes, patient outcomes. And they really want to understand how and that kind of stick with me and it became sort of my driver in terms of, okay, I think I need to understand a bit better why does manipulate or how does spinal manipulation work and for who. So we can clearly see that there are some patients that respond very well, other patients don't respond so well. So that's sort of like a thing that I was getting from like a clinical observation that initially drove me towards like a research. So in Brazil, I practiced for 5 years, and like the last 2 years, I was like part-time practicing, but was a very busy clinic, although was part-time doing while I was doing my master's. And after finishing my master's, I flew to Guelph and did my PhD over there. But in my master's as well, so I was also interested in understanding the mechanism. So I end up doing this, my master's was like in basic biological science, physiology, human physiology in a neurobiological lab. And we aim, or the main goal of the lab, it is to understand the underlying mechanisms of chronic pain, including neuropathic pain. So it was a nice feat because I brought this like idea of a therapeutic intervention, and the lab was used to do some sort of basic science or preclinical studies in chronic pain and or pain mechanism. So was a kind of a nice blend at that time. So it kind of guided me in terms of achieving my aims, which was start understanding or unveiling a little bit more the mechanisms of manual therapy. And from there, I went to Canada and did my PhD with under John Serbo's guidance in the University of Guelph. And he is one of the experts in central sensitization. So I think he also kind of was a great blending because I was studying the mechanisms or the neurobiological mechanisms of chronic pain in preclinical modules during my master's, and John Serbo was studying the mechanisms involved in central sensitization, a little bit of context of osteoarthritis and myofascial pain as well, which kind of became part of my thesis, and it was very nice as well. So that experience doing my PhD studies. Yeah.
Yeah, that's awesome. I particularly like the idea that you were in a lab that was basically basic science, and you had this clinical aspect of things, and the questions that you had were probably a little bit more clinically oriented than many of the people in the lab. And I found myself in a similar situation, but it makes for nice research, doesn't it, to be able to blend the two?
It does. I think that's very important. So when you bring like your clinical observation, clinical experience, you always, I think, not always, but most of the times, you also tend to bring perhaps a more like a clinically relevant questions as well, or more clinically applied, or something that perhaps not right now, but in the future will end up translating to a more like a human or clinical perspective. So I think that's the beauty of being, for example, a practitioner and also doing research. I think it's a great blending. Yeah, 100%.
Yeah. Well, before we get to your research, I wanted to make sure that we talked a little bit about where you're at now. You know, are you strictly doing research and teaching? Is there any practice component to it? Tell us what you're up to there in Australia.
Yeah, sure, Dean. So once I finished my PhD, I did my postdoctoral fellowship at CMCC and also at Toronto Rehab Institution, like KITE. And that was very, very inspiring. Because at Toronto Rehab, so at TRI, so you end up getting in touch with a lot of complex clinical conditions, such as like a spinal cord injury and also chronic musculoskeletal disorders, especially fibromyalgia. So very complex case scenarios. So when you see that, it kind of, wow, that seems a little bit different than our, let's say, clinical practice, our private clinical practice. I think that was very inspiring and kind of opened like a kind of a new horizon for me in terms of, wow, I think I should do this, or perhaps I should bring more on this side and so on. But was very nice. And my time at CMCC as a postdoctoral fellow was very nice as well, because I had the opportunity to work with legends like in this sort of field, such as like the Ingenians and who they do a lot of biomarkers, blood stuff. So that was very nice. And also had the opportunity to first time in my life to get in touch with new technologies, especially focusing on manual therapies, such as like the force sensing table, which is, we're definitely going to talk later about the studies that I did on that table. So getting in touch with new things was very nice, and I think a little bit more clinically applied. So I transitioned from more like a preclinical basic science towards like a more clinical, but bringing the basic science touch into the clinical aspect. So that was kind of a very nice transition. And right now, I am at CKU University, where I'm most, my position is mostly teaching and a little bit of research as well. I'm not practicing, and I didn't practice in Canada as well. There are some politics and some aspects that I don't intend to go into through this podcast, but because of Fevale University in Brazil, there is no accredited university like under the International Educational Chiropractic Program, that sort of thing. So our diplomas, we have trouble, let's say, getting into the board exams and doing the board exams and revalidating the diploma abroad. So that's a little bit sad, let's say. It's not that I don't want or I didn't want to practice, but there's some limitations, unfortunately, that I believe that they will be solved very, very shortly, because there is, let's say, a forced task right now in Latin America that there is this accreditation, new accredited body that in Latin America that is working towards facilitating that sort of like revalidation of diplomas in Brazil abroad. So let's see how things will go like soon after this podcast. But yeah, but right now I'm more like in the teaching and in research and doing a lot of teaching in my goal in the teaching is to blend or to transition the basic science with clinical science. So I teach anatomy, neuroanatomy, and also advanced neurological assessment and diagnosis. And my goal, it is to bridge, kind of be the facilitator for the students to understand the basic concepts of anatomy into clinical practice. I think that's my main goal as like as an educator in a Caro school. Yes.
Excellent. That was a great summary. I appreciate that. Could you give us just a brief overview in your own words of what your research is all about? What are you trying to achieve?
Yeah, sure. So my main goal it is to understand the neurobiological mechanisms of chronic pain disorders, including neck pain and low back pain, but also more complex disorders such as fibromyalgia. So why understanding the molecular aspects that are happening, let's say, in the spinal cord level or in the brain level, and how those things actually translate into clinical symptoms, for example. So from like a more biological point of view, than a psychosocial point of view. That's kind of where I am. I'm not, first of all, please don't get me wrong. It's just the research I do. I super validate the psychosocial, the psychological aspects, and also the social aspects in chronic pain conditions. But it's just the things I do. I focus more in the biological. But I think at the end of the day, the three elements are kind of communicating, and that is this intrinsic relationship between biological, psychological, and social aspects. So I think that is like this two-way communication between all these elements. So this is one of the elements. The other one, it is focused on manual therapy, especially spinal manipulation. So my main goal, it is to understand whether or not force and speed, for example, or some of the force characteristic elements of the manual therapy, they matter, first of all, in a mechanistic approach, in terms of molecular, in terms of like sensory or somatosensory outcomes. So if they change those outcomes, and ultimately, aiming to transition or to translate this, for example, findings, potential findings in clinical practice. So for example, the variability between chiropractors in terms of force and speed matter for patient outcomes or not? So we understand as well that depends on the clinical context and clinical interaction. So we know that those elements play important roles, but I'm more interested again, in the mechanical aspect and the biological aspect. So the mechanobiology, we call this field like a mechanobiology. And I think we are very well, let's say, set our profession because we use a mechanic, a therapy. So let's say the forefront of our treatment in a chiropractic care, it is manual therapy. So I think we really need, and I think and patients deserve to understand as well from a safety point of view as well and a public point of view as well, which whether or not force matters or in terms of and also in terms of dosage and so on. I think this is the other element. And ultimately, obviously, kind of understanding which patients will respond better. So which situation, which clinical scenario. So what type of treatment you need to add on those patients. That is, let's say, the ultimate goal, like sort of the precise medicine, sort of not philosophy, but the precise medicine rationale. So triggering or trimming the treatment according to every individual patient. So it is still part of a patient-centered approach, but from, let's say, a manual therapy point of view. So whether or not this patient deserves to receive, for example, 400 newtons for manipulation or 800 newtons manipulation or some sort of like that. So that would be, let's say, the dream outcome from all this line of research.
Fantastic. Yeah. Well, let's just move on and we'll talk about these papers. And the first theme or concept that we can talk about, you've done some animal work with instrument-assisted manipulation, looking at biomarkers in the blood and the spinal cord and peripheral nerves. So why don't we talk about one paper, maybe just briefly, if we could. And this one's titled, Spinal Manipulation Therapy Improves Tactile Allodynia and Peripheral Nerve Functionality and Modulates Blood Oxidative Stress Markers in Rats Exposed to Knee Joint Immobilization. And that comes from JMPT 2019.
Yeah, that's correct. So I think this study was part of my master's thesis. And our main goal was to understand whether or not the spinal manipulation would change or would be able to change those, let's say, inflammatory related markers, which were like oxidative stress in the blood of these animals. So these animals were like, they underwent to a model of a complex regional pain syndrome. So which is pretty much like the immobilization in the leg. And they were immobilized for a little bit, for a couple of weeks. And we addressed the treatment after the module. So the treatment was done over 3 weeks, three times a week. And we aim to measure those things in the blood or in the systemic changes. And also we address some functional changes as well, such as mechanical sensitivity and also mobility, like a functional mobility of those, especially targeting the immobilized hind limb of these animals. We were successful both in the module and also the treatment responded very well. So we were able to identify that the activator in this case applied in the lumbar spine of these animals would lead to the activator treatment led to modification or modulation of those biological markers related to oxidative stress. And these markers were related with the improvements in mechanical sensitivity and also the functionality or the mobility of these animals. I think what we can talk here, it is about perhaps the oxidative stress. Perhaps it's a new word or a new component here. So I just wanted to make sure everybody understands that. So oxidative stress is pretty much the product that every single cell that releases during this oxidative process. So the metabolism, so there's the glucose, there is kind of a burning of glucose, and there are some molecules that will be spewed from these cells. And there is a buffering system that will aim to dampen these molecules. And when there is, let's say, a disbalance or unbalanced in terms of production and buffering these molecules, we call oxidative stress. There is a reaction that is called oxidative stress. And these molecules, if they connect with different cells, for example, in cellular membrane, they will react with the lipids. Remember the biphosphate lipid layer in the cells. So they can react with those lipids and they can lead to unhealthy reactions, and they can change, modify the cellular signaling and modify ion channels and so on. So they can be, they can damage the other cells, but eventually they can be also positive because the, you know, that is an important response in terms of adaptation. So whenever you need to adapt or your cell need to adapt to a certain situations, so the oxidative stress are very important for leading a new adaptation. I will give a practical example in terms of a tissue regeneration. So oxidative stress is very important for leading or driving the tissue regeneration. So it needs to have this kind of stress environment in order to create an adaptation. And the adaptation can be positive or can be negative. And usually it depends on your system or the ability of your system to buffer these reactions, and also the ability of your system, or actually more the amount of oxidative stress that is also being released. So what we found in this study was that there was a peak of oxidative stress after this preclinical module, and the activator was able to dampen or to buffer this oxidative stress reaction, and this buffering system was associated with a clinically relevant improvements, not clinical because it was a preclinical, but in terms of improvement of function and also improvement on the mechanical sensitivity. So that's kind of a summary of this paper and also a summary about oxidative stress, Dean.
I appreciate that. I just find it very fascinating that, you know, manipulating the lumbar spine in these rats led to this buffering systemically. It's amazing to think about that it could have such a systemic effect. What kinds of other things would have an effect like that? I don't know if you'd know that, but would exercise do something like that? Is there anything else, nutrition, supplements, the food that we eat, would they have similar kinds of effects?
Yeah, pretty much. So on top of those that you already listed, Dean, so let's say exercise, diet, we can also add perhaps drugs, medicines as well, that can have a systemic effect as well. But not only those, so even like a massage therapy can also lead to those important systemic changes. So very interesting. So we don't know exactly how these systemic changes are, like, let's say, driven. We know, for example, from a manual therapy perspective, so there is a mechanical stimulation that can eventually be driven by the sensory system in activation of autonomic system reaction. This is one of the possibilities, and there is evidence on that. But the other thing could be like a more local reaction, but local meant, for example, in the endothelial cells that are part or important components of the blood vessels. So we know that endothelial cells, they have important, channels or ion channels that are, they are able to perceive mechanical stimuli. And once they perceive the mechanical stimuli, they will give a reaction, or they will give an output. So there will be an output from this mechanical perception from the cellular point of view. And one of these mechanical outputs could be, let's say, increasing the metabolism, increasing the oxidation, and the release of oxidative stress markers. So this is one of the theories, one of the possibilities. The other possibility, obviously, could be affecting the immune system as well. Okay, so affecting the white blood cells, such as macrophages, monocytes, for example, and we know that these white blood cells are quite important, and they use a lot oxidative stress and the release of these markers in the context of getting rid of the foreigners like bodies such as virus and bacteria. So this is one of the mechanisms, one of the possibilities, or a few possibilities, and this can be measured systemically. So yeah, so we know that exercise also affects these components. We know that diet is also able to affect all these components, and drugs as well, so just like medicine.
Well,
yeah, very interesting.
Yes.
Yeah, very powerful. We have a very powerful thing in our hands, Dean.
Yes, we do.
We treat these patients.
We do. Yes. And I know a lot of people in practice tend to couple these things together, like nutritional advice, mm-hmm. Along with exercise, along with the hands-on kind of care. So that is exciting.
Yeah, it is exciting in terms of like from a clinical practice point of view, it is ideal. So again, Dean, don't get me wrong. I usually do mechanistic studies, for example, like this preclinical study that aim to understand the mechanisms or one of the underlying mechanisms of manual therapy. But I'm not at any moment disregarding or ruling out the importance of other factors in the clinical practice. So this is one thing. My goal is to understand the mechanisms of manual therapy. This is one thing, just let make very clear. The other thing, it is in the clinical practice. When we use a few other elements, we use manual therapy, we use diet advice, we use physical rehab advice as well, plus psychosocial advice whenever is needed. So I think all the elements will play a role. But this little piece of evidence here was more like about the manual therapy.
Perfect. Well, yeah. There's another paper that goes along with this theme, published in Pain Medicine 2021. This was spine adjusting using the impulse instrument, attenuates nociception and modulates oxidative stress markers in the spinal cord and sciatic nerve of a rat model of neuropathic pain. So I wonder if you could guide us through this paper.
Yeah, sure. I think, first of all, so neuropathic pain, like sort of like it's characterized by like a disorder or a disease affecting the somatosensory system. So in this particular preclinical module, so we use ligands to create a module of a sciatic type of pain. So like a neuropathic pain that is affecting the sciatic nerve. And we use a few other like groups. So we divide in naive. So animals were like kind of, they had none in terms of intervention. Yes, they received intervention, but they had no module. So no neuropathic pain. So we had a second group that we expose the sciatic nerve. So we open the muscle, we expose the sciatic nerve, but we close the muscle. We didn't touch the sciatic nerve. And we had this real module, let's say, that we wanted to get the most important one, that we wanted to see the effects of the treatment. So where we created this sciatic, so we didn't create, so this is very established in the literature, this sciatic nerve injury module. And I think that the response is kind of, it is the outcomes from this study was in line with my previous study, which we also saw, that 2 weeks of treatment, I think in this study, we did 2 weeks of treatment, three times a week, in these animals, applying the impulse at this time, so not the activator. We apply the impulse at the L4 and L5 segments, the spinous process of these animals, and we were able to see, improvements in the mechanical sensitivity from these animals. We also were able to measure the thermal sensitivity as well. So these animals improved the thermal sensitivity. So the threshold was actually lower So in terms of getting the thermal sensitivity in these animals, and the threshold, we were able to increase the threshold. So it was harder after receiving the treatment to get this thermal sensitivity in these animals. The other element that we measured was like a spinal cord, and we also measured these oxidative stress markers and the spinal cord level. And we also measure at the sciatic nerve as well. So we measure, like, let's say, in the central nervous system, the oxidative stress, and we also measure in the peripheral nervous system, in the sciatic nerve itself. And all impressive. So most of the oxidative stress markers, they were improved. So improved in the context of having antioxidants. So the antioxidants were, let's say, higher, and the treatment was able to increase the antioxidants to counterbalance the production of the oxidative stress markers. So we associated that this counterbalancing mechanism that we observed both at the spinal cord level, so at the spinal cord, so the segments related where, so L4, L5, and L3 levels, so we measure that sort of segment at the spinal cord, so kind of a local where we apply the treatment, but also the, in the sciatic nerve, in the peripheral nerve, so we observed a same behavior. So the treatment was able to increase the antioxidant production, so the production of the antioxidant, or like fine-tuning the antioxidative system in order to buffer the production of the oxidative stress. So I think, again, in line with the previous studies, with our previous study in blood, what we observed systemically, we also observed this same pattern happening at the spinal cord level and also at the peripheral nerve level. So meaning that a systemic, let's say, again, this is, we are a little bit of not extrapolating, but creating a few ideas here. One of the possible mechanisms could be that the systemic measurements or the systemic biomarkers could also be a result from the oxidative stress that is coming from the spinal cord and the sciatic nerve. So eventually you can get some spills from that reaction from the spinal cord and from the peripheral nerve that can be measured in the blood, in plasma or serum. And eventually you can also have an effect systemically as well. So, yeah.
Yeah.
Not sure if I was clear. This part of this study, Dan, please let me know.
Yeah, okay. I think very clear. You know, it gets me thinking, I mean, there's so many interesting tidbits to to talk about this. At the moment, though, I'm kind of thinking, all right, so I think the average clinician, average person might think to themselves, okay, reactive oxygen species sounds like something that may not be great over a long period of time. So, you know, things that I've read, for example, if you have a lot of reactive oxygen species that can donate electrons and can mess up your proteins, et cetera, amongst a host of other things that it can do. Are there any benefits to generating these reactive oxygen species? I mean, so I'm thinking the antioxidant component, you know, that sounds really good to me. Are there any negatives or any positives rather to the reactive oxygen species?
Yeah, sure. So we know that the reactive oxygen species and the oxidative stress, it is important, for example, for the establishment. So I'm going to bring the negative as well here.
Sure.
For the establishment and the development of a chronic pain, especially central sensitization and also memory formation. So long-term potentiation, a few other neurobiological elements. So reactive oxygen species is quite important for that sort of adaptation. okay, and development. But it is also, in the negative side, oxidative stress and increase in oxidative stress is being associated with a cardiovascular disorders as well, muscle damage, and also, for example, multiple sclerosis. So it's part of the pathophysiology of these conditions.
Okay? Got it.
But here, so let's bring the positive elements. We're pretty much talking, when we talk about the negative, we talk especially about a very important increase of oxidative stress and a chronic oxidative stress. Okay, so we are not talking about, for example, peaks or like a sort of increase of the levels, but not an increase that leads to a damage, a cellular damage, but an increase that eventually leads to a signaling or an adaptation. As I mentioned before, so oxidative stress is also important for tissue regeneration and the anti-inflammatory cascade as well, but in certain in controlled amounts. So you cannot have like this oxidative stress like chronically. So this will definitely lead to deficits in cellular function and eventually in systemic function as well. However, in a certain and controlled amounts, oxidative stress is quite important, especially for a tissue adaptation. And I'm thinking right now about healing, for example, a lesion healing, acute lesion. So oxidative stress is quite important driving that, because it signals to other anti-inflammatory and inflammatory cytokines to come to the place and play a role and create the healing thing. Okay, but also in terms of adaptation for memory as well. So oxidative stress in certain amounts, they are quite beneficial for creating long-term memory. As I mentioned, it is related with long-term potentiation. And long-term potentiation, it is the neurobiological mechanism that is underlining, for example, the establishment of chronic pain, and also the establishment of memory. So they also play these roles. So I think that's kind of a summary, and that's kind of the dual or the both sides of oxidative stress. Let's say if you have a chronic and very high peaks, so it can be damaging. But if you have like a control and eventual peaks, it leads to signaling and adaptation. So it's beneficial.
Perfect. Yeah, I think you explained that very well. So I appreciate that. I know clinicians out there would be thinking the same thing. So I try to ask what they might ask.
So 100%.
Yeah. Okay. So the next theme that I want to get to is the force sensing table and right. The modulation of force relative to these biomarkers. How does modulating force affect these blood biomarkers and inflammation? So the paper that we'll talk about next is effects of distinct force magnitude of spinal manipulative therapy on blood biomarkers of inflammation, a proof of principle study in healthy young adults. And that's in JMPT 2022. And by the way, all of these references will be online for everybody to look at and get to. So, but Felipe, could you walk us through this paper?
Sure, 100%. And this paper, so that is also an upcoming paper that has been submitted. And it is in the same line, same participants, but looking to a different perspective. So looking to oxidative stress markers, and I think this paper you're referring, we look at into cytokines, so inflammatory cytokines. I think the idea of this paper was, okay, so how does force time characteristic play a role in the biological system? There has been some evidence showing that some of the variables of force and time characteristics of the spinal manipulation can have an effect on an electrophysiological effect, but we didn't know if this could have also an effect in terms of a biological effect. So that was pretty much the rationale. So we divided it in this study. Unfortunately, this study was, we were just about getting a nice and ramping up in terms of patient recruitment, so participant recruitment in this study when the COVID pandemic hit. So we were heavily impacted. So we, unfortunately, we didn't achieve our sample size goals that we calculated and that so on. So there are some methodological issues in this, let's say, paper, especially on the sample size. So we need to be very careful on extrapolation always, right? But in the context of this study, so we had three different groups. We have one group receiving 200 newtons in non-imposed, so like just a presetting, so pre-manipulation without the trusting phase. So we had a second group of participants. They received 400 newtons trust in the thoracic spine between T6 and T8 or T9. And we had the third group, which received 800 newtons thoracic spinal manipulation, pretty much doubling the 400 newtons spinal manipulation. So we wanted to see if these force specifically, talking about force, if force would matter or not in terms of the biological outcomes. And what we observed in this particular study was that we measure, first of all, we measure right away after manipulation, and we measure also 20 minutes. So pretty much a short-term effects in after manipulation. So what we observed was that we observe, let's say, quite different response and behavior in terms of pro-inflammatory and anti-inflammatory, and also oxidative stress biomarkers in these participants. We tend to observe that in 800 newtons participants, there was an increase of oxidative stress and also an increase of pro-inflammatory cytokines. A few, not all pro-inflammatory cytokines. Okay? Some pro-inflammatory cytokines. We also observe in this 800 newtons, let's say, a decrease in antioxidant. Antioxidants were decreased, assuming that they were, for example, consumed by the peak increase of the oxidative stress. Remember, this is a balanced system. Whenever you have an increase of oxidative stress or reactive oxygen species, you want to have a buffering system. And when this buffering system is consumed, which seems to be the case of the 800 newtons, so we also had this increase of reactive oxygen species. Okay, so this is what we observed in 800 newtons patients, participants, I'm sorry. And we observed in 400 newtons the opposite. We observed a decrease in oxidative stress, a decrease in pro-inflammatory cytokines, and we didn't observe any changes in antioxidant system. Okay, so what does that mean? It could mean a few things, but I think first of all, I think it's important to establish that the increase we are talking is an increase that is not, it shouldn't lead to important and chronic damage. Okay, so we are not talking about the same increase as we observe in cardiovascular conditions or in kidney conditions or in neurodegenerative conditions. Okay, so we are talking about an increase, but more likely to be an adaptive increase, similar to what I was explaining before, okay? The beneficial aspect, it seems to be more in that kind of bucket, okay? Because we didn't observe like a super peak increases that could potentially lead to damage. I'm not saying that we need further investigation, obviously, but it's just to make things quite clear here, okay? So what I'm assuming and my understanding from this study is that 800 newtons is important in terms of creating a cellular stress, a metabolism. It definitely increases metabolism of important cellular components. I'm not sure which cell we are talking here because we measure in blood, okay? We measure in serum, so we measure systemically. So what we know from the literature that the most important cells that spill their elements in the circular system are immune cells, especially macrophages and monocytes. We know that epithelial cells and endothelial cells, so pretty much skin cells and blood vessel cells, they also spill their these elements in the blood, in the systemic blood, and also muscle. Okay, so these are, let's say, three important components that will can be leading to this, for example, increase or this spills that in this biological marker that we observed in the 800 newtons participants. In contrast, as I mentioned, we observed a decrease in these markers in a 400 newtons. Okay, perhaps one of the hypotheses that can come from this study is that perhaps whenever a patient needs or requires more of like a cellular adaptation or an adaptive condition, perhaps applying 800 newtons spinal manipulation in the thoracic spine could be more beneficial compared to applying a 400 newtons spinal manipulation. But this is, again, we are too early in this research to make any strong assumptions about this. So I rather to stay with the, what the evidence is pointing that, yes, in terms of a biological, from a biological point of view, from inflammatory and anti-inflammatory and oxidative and antioxidative system. So there are differences whenever you apply a 400 newtons and 800 newtons. What do these differences mean in terms of clinical outcomes? I have no idea.
Not yet. that's just honest. I mean, that's good.
Yeah. No, 100%. I think we have a responsibility when we are kind of talking and discussing the outcomes and findings from studies like this, especially from the clinical point of view. And again, I don't want to create any false statement saying that the 800 newtons is bad because it creates more pro-inflammatory and 400 newtons is good because it creates less pro-inflammatory. Because we don't know. We really don't know in terms of a clinical outcome.
Sure.
So
sure.
This is definitely a following up study, so that we are planning to do and so on. So it is in the target, it is in the radar to do a follow up study that's more to bring also a clinical population. So these were like young adults again. So this is the other element. Okay. But again, this is an important foundational in terms from a mechanistic point of view. I think that that's the beauty of this study. It is needed, okay, from a safety point of view. So we also don't know, for example, from a safety point of view, what we know, let's say that, for example, DOMS, so delayed onset muscle soreness, for example, there is an increase of oxidative stress for a few hours and for a few days as well, together with an increase of inflammatory response. Okay, so we know that these elements are potential underlying underliners of the symptoms. Okay. From a safety point of view, we know that there are some benign reactions, especially some muscle soreness that are related with spinal manipulation. Not in every single patient, but some patients will experience some benign adverse events, let's say. Okay. And eventually these are triggering or the, underlining these adverse events, we also don't know. So this is another research line that we are investigating as well. So there are a few things that we can kind of, let's say, unroll from this mechanistic study that can drive future clinical studies as well.
Sure. Well, I've got a just a couple of questions about that then. So the first one relates to the how you selected the Newtons, 200, 400, 800. So with 400 and 800, my this is not my area of research, but the last couple of mechanistic papers I've read would suggest that that is right in the therapeutic range of manipulation. So I'm assuming that's why you picked the 400 and 800, maybe sort of on the lighter side of a manipulation and the little, we'll say, heavier side of it.
That's right.
Okay. And yeah. So, I mean, still being in practice, you know, just thinking of the last few people I've seen here this week, you know, you might have somebody who's may never have seen a chiropractor, have a lot of years of stiffness, and you put a force into their spine and it may be, you know, a little on the heavier side, let's say. And yeah, I was glad you brought up that idea of, muscle soreness because although you can't predict it all the time, normally clinically, I just tell people that they should probably expect it. Because you don't want anybody to get really sore, you know, right after and not have a clue that they could get sore. The other thing is that normally that is very short lasting, as you mentioned. And so I guess my next thought was getting back to the exercise, and you kind of mentioned it a bit, you know, I guess to me, it sounds similar to acute exercise where with acute exercise, you could have some pro-inflammatory cytokines that are released. And you know, some people even get sick sometimes after that because of the immune system lowering, we'll say. But chronic regular exercise seems to be a substantial boost. And I'm not suggesting necessarily that everybody needs to get adjusted, you know, with a certain frequency. That's up to the chiropractor to decide. But it does make me wonder about the sort of balance, if you will, that sometimes we may experience some of this pro-inflammatory, but the preponderance of the evidence, at least in the animal studies and at least at 400 newtons, would suggest an anti-inflammatory effect.
That's correct. That's correct, Tim. And I think this sort of like a research line is heavily inspired by studies previously done in physical exercise. And what we are seeing and like witnessing here, it is sort of a very similar pattern. And what I'm kind of, what I wonder from this pattern that we are seeing is that there are some beneficial aspects that we get from like an acute response and other type of benefits that we get from a chronic response in the same line as you just described. So we don't know yet if this dosage in terms of forces, how important they are in a clinical population. We don't know in terms of frequency as well. But what we are kind of witnessing from this kind of a small piloting study here and using force sensing table is that we are seeing very similar patterns that we have seen in physical exercises, let's say about 20 years ago when this kind of first like studies were done, let's say 20, 25 years ago like a bolt of exercise, acute response, and then exploring a more long-term response. And after that, they kind of explore more systemic response, what happens in the muscle, but also what happens in the nervous system, what happens in the brain, what happens in the liver, and so on and so on. So I think that's a very interesting point of view and a pattern that we are kind of experiencing and observing from studies in manual therapy and the biological effects. So I think it's the cellular and the systemic system that is kind of working together upon a mechanical sort of therapy, because at the end of the day, physical exercise is also a sort of a mechanical therapy as well, or a mechanical activity. It makes your bones and muscles and entire system moves around, so you're kind of putting forces, you're putting some speed in a similar fashion as you're putting in a spinal manipulation. Obviously, again, don't get me wrong, they're very different modalities, but in terms of the core concepts, they are both mechanical sort of stimuli that may have both an impact systemically as well.
Yeah, I like drawing the similarities between them. Yeah, they're certainly differences, but there are many similarities. So that's a nice thing to compare to. Well, I want to make sure we get to this last theme here, which is on myofascial pain and osteoarthritis. So the first paper in that one is re-examining myofascial pain syndrome toward biomarker development and mechanism-based diagnostic criteria. And this is in Current Rheumatology Report 2021. So if you could give us an overview of that paper, that'd be great.
Sure. I think that this paper, it kind of solidifies some of the ideas that from my PhD thesis, which was heavily on myofascial pain, central sensitization, neurogenic inflammation, spreading inflammation from one point, from one dermatome to other dermatomes. I think that kind of speaks a little bit. And especially some of the fundamental concepts. I think this paper was more like a sort of a commentary, not a commentary, but it was more like an overview that aimed to for the reader to kind of start thinking a little bit outside of the box. For example, how successful have we been when we only target a local myofascial trigger point? So that's one of the questions. So some patients will present improvements, other patients won't present improvements, as every single patient in every single condition. Yes, I get it. But should we move from a local muscle reaction that we have conflicting evidence on ultrasound and also on palpation and move this field more towards other elements that we can measure in a clinical, for example, and also in a research setting, we can measure like blood. Okay, can we measure this? Is this feasible to measure in clinical practice? Maybe not so much, but can we add other elements such as patient-reported outcomes? Can we do temporal summation? Can we measure PPT? Can we do other elements in clinical practice? Can we add like the psychosocial element in clinical practice that we can perhaps think outside of the box of only palpating trigger points and treating trigger points and expecting that you're going to get the same response and same improvement from every single patient that we treat with dry needling or you treat with like a thumb pressure. So this was more like this paper was more like a kind of a questioning what we've done so far and perhaps giving future suggestions on how to move the field forward. Because this field is so interesting, but is also in terms of research is a little bit undervalued as well. But this seems to be myofascial pain seems to be a condition. And we are going to talk about this in a following paper. That seems to be a condition that can be observed together with other conditions, but can also be observed in a standing alone condition. And we also have this theory that can myofascial pain, let's say, evolve and become a fibromyalgia? So what are the elements? So can we identify patients, can we identify that are different in terms of treatment response and profile? That, okay, so I'm pretty sure that doing a dry needling in this patient, we're going to get some improvement. But this second patient here, it has important psychosocial elements together with the trigger point. Can we perhaps address the trigger point, but can we perhaps also address the psychosocial element as well? So this was more like the intention of this paper. And I think at the very end, we suggest the field to conduct like a Delphi statement in order to create some sort of a patient-reported outcome that perhaps is a bit more broad and meaningful, that walks a little bit away, not walks away, but adds on the trigger point identification and palpation. I think that was the main goal of this study, Dean.
Yeah, and you had talked earlier about responders and non-responders, and that makes good sense, especially in this context where, you know, some of the biomarkers that you may be looking at, like you say, some may be appropriate in clinical practice environment, some may not be, but in the research setting, certainly you could test all of those biomarkers and perhaps come up with a way that clinicians could use, even if they're not doing the tests themselves, they could use some of the aspects that you've achieved through research and be able to identify perhaps in a slightly different way or characterize it in a slightly different way in practice. It would seem to me anyways.
Yeah, exactly, Dean. And perhaps I will highlight one of the elements that we spoke in this paper. That is evidence is piling up around the BDNF, which is a growth factor that is associated with neuroplasticity. And in this field of myofascial pain, there is a few groups that have done important investigation on BDNF in treatment response on myofascial pain syndrome. And it seems that those patients, just based on these few studies, the patients that present like an increase in the BDNF and present a longer, chronic pain or symptoms associated with the trigger point and myofascial pain, they are like about the patients that respond poorly to dry needling. And for example, and also thumb pressure. So, yeah. So a few elements that I know we are at this moment a bit far away to bring this BDNF measurement in our clinical practice. But I think one of the goals of this manuscript was to also update the reader in terms of what's being done and how the field is kind of walking in order to add other elements on top of palpation of trigger points. So, for example, this BDNF, it's one of the elements that eventually are involved in this neuroplasticity, and this could be a negative neuroplasticity because BDNF, together with oxidative stress, is important to solidify chronic pain from a neurobiological perspective.
So the BDNF, just I'm not sure if I caught the relationship exactly. So is that a higher BDNF is associated with the myofascial trigger points or a lower BDNF?
So higher BDNF has been associated with a poor response on myofascial pain treatment.
Wow.
This is just one example. But there are a few other examples in this paper, such as a PPT response. So PPT is something that we can use more like in a clinical practice, and how PPT has been associated with myofascial trigger points. So PPT can be has been shown to be used and be important to both the identification of the trigger point besides the palpation. So for example, you do the palpation and you have like a kind of a more reliable sort of semi-quantitative thing that comes from the PPT on the local pain response. And this has been shown some important value in terms of a treatment response. So in a subsequent visit, when the patient comes, so you can illustrate to the patient that, oh, look, we did this, and that is an improvement in your, for example, range of motion of the neck. Just thinking right now on the trapezius, for example, a trigger point on the trapezius, PPT on trapezius, and thinking about the range of motion of the neck. Okay, so yeah, we can see that together with the range improvements in the range of motion of your neck, we can also see, let's say, a sensory or a somatosensory response. So because your thresholds on PPT kind of went higher and they were lower before, meaning that there was more sensitive. So there was a sensitive spot, and right now you're kind of improving on that one. So this is also an interesting point of view that can be used in clinical practice, for example.
Yeah, for sure. A few years back, I got one of these units that measure the PPT, one of these electronic ones, and I used it for a while, and then I thought, well, I don't know, my fingers are pretty good too. So, I mean, good. No, it was good to see the numbers, you know what I mean? But when push comes to shove, like chiropractors are doing this all day long, basically.
Sure. No, and it's totally understandable. So there are a few things that are will be easier, let's say, to implement in clinical practice. And I think PPT, it is easy to implement.
Yes.
But yeah, how I don't know, is this like something that is... what is the word? Like, not consistent. Can you use this consistently in every single patient, or do you need to use this consistently? Or perhaps you're going to use this in a few other patients. And I'm bringing PPT because also in that BDNF study, okay, I just remember why I brought the PPT into play here. So this is an instrument that can be easily implemented in clinical practice and was also associated with the increased of BDNF.
Ah.
Okay. So, yeah. So these are a few elements that are like the field is kind of moving. So bringing the clinical thing or something that is easy to implement in clinical practice plus something that's more research or more, let's say, BDNF measurement. This is just an example.
Sure. Well, that gives us lots to think about for sure. Well, let's get on to the last paper here, which is myofascial pain as an unseen comorbidity in osteoarthritis. And this was a scoping review in Clinical Journal of Pain in 2023. So I wonder if you could guide us through this one as well.
Sure. So, Dean, in this study, again, I think this study was an important reflection, again, from my PhD thesis. And was this, I think the idea behind this study, although this was a scoping review, but my main goal was to see what has been done in clinical practice that has been, let's say, put together myofascial trigger point and another, let's say, pathological condition, which is osteoarthritis. Okay, so one of my PhD study, I did this, I actually designed this study to understand the implication of a painful or chronic painful condition or symptomatic condition, which was osteoarthritis, and this was an animal study, preclinical study. And the reflection, So we wanted to observe all these biomarkers and things we talked today, cytokines, reactive oxygen species, in the local tissue. But we also wanted to investigate in another tissue that was very closely related, but wasn't, for example, the knee joint, wasn't the cartilage, wasn't the synovial fluid. But I also wanted to investigate what actually was happening at the muscle level, for example, in one of my PhD studies. And what we observe, that some not at the same level, but various elements that we observed that increase, let's say, the inflammatory and other peptides that are important in the synovial fluid and in the cartilage that are important for the establishment of osteoarthritis, we saw some of this, let's say, spills in the muscle as well. Okay, so that was pretty much the theory, that are these, let's say, inflammatory soup that is coming from a secondary pathology, such as osteoarthritis, are these inflammatory soup that are being spilled in the muscle important for, like, let's say, pain sensitization in the muscle and eventually a trigger point formation? We didn't measure the trigger point formation because, unfortunately, that is not a very good standard way to measure what is a trigger point. The definition is still shady, let's say. However, we objectively were able to measure that inflammatory cytokines that are classically being described, that are components of a myofascial trigger point, they were present in the muscle. Okay? Sorry. And what we wanted to do with this scoping review here was that we walked away from the biological thing, which is the inflammatory soup, but we wanted to see, or this scoping review aimed to investigate the presence of a trigger point in a secondary muscle that is closely related. Okay, so it was a little bit of extrapolation because it brings the information, the fundamental information, that these biological components are possible drivers of a trigger point formation. However, in this scoping review, we didn't find any biological components in a secondary tissue, but what we were able to find in the literature was the trigger point itself or themselves. Okay, so that was the idea. So we have an osteoarthritis and we have myofascial pain syndrome that is mainly characterized by the presence of active or latent trigger points. Okay, what we observe in this scoping review, that especially knee and hip osteoarthritis, so you can expect to get active trigger points, especially around the quadriceps and hamstrings, for example, in patients with knee and hip osteoarthritis. Okay, so the two conditions are happening together. We want to think about mechanisms. Or is this because of the mechanical loading disbalance, or is this because of this crazy neurobiological thing that you are describing, Felipe? I don't know the mechanism. I know that you can expect that if you see a patient with knee osteoarthritis, you can expect to see also myofascial trigger points. Okay. The theory behind, again, comes from a PhD thesis that the local trigger point is not only, for example, made by a local injury, but can be also consequence of another secondary injury that is not local injury, but a secondary injury that is another place that can also spill these inflammatory markers and end up leading to a trigger point formation. This is the theory behind.
Okay. Yeah. So in reading this paper, you had mentioned about, you know, which comes first, the myofascial pain, the trigger point, or the arthritis, or do they come on together? What are your What are your thoughts? Is there a...
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, fantastic. So yeah, this was, again, was one of the discussion points from this paper and was also a question to the reader as well. So I think the main goal, it is that we can assume... I know that in science it's so hard to assume, and I'm kind of against this word. I don't like to use the word assuming, but we can perhaps expect that both can come together. They can be present together, but myofascial trigger point eventually can be a driver of osteoarthritis because of this neurological communication that is clearly that it not only from my PhD studies, but there's also like in neuropathic pain studies and other studies, that is this neurological communication between the, let's say, adjacent tissues, such as nervous system, muscles, and spine or knee joints, something like this. So you can eventually expect this could be a driver. Am I saying that this is the main driver? This is the sole driver, the only driver? No, I'm not saying that. So there are many other factors, genetic factors, environmental factors, etc., etc. But I'm saying that perhaps this can contribute to at least the pain and the symptomatic aspect of osteoarthritis, because there are also osteoarthritis that are asymptomatic. Perhaps this can play a role in the symptomatic aspect of osteoarthritis, myofascial trigger points. But also the other way around. So osteoarthritis, because of X, Y, and Z, so biomechanical changes, neurological changes, environment changes, can also eventually lead to the formation of trigger point in an adjacent tissue, such as a muscle, that can eventually feed this cycle or this looping that will feed the symptomatic osteoarthritis and also feeding the stiffness, limitations on the muscle, range of motions, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. This is one of the potential theories. Yeah, yeah, yeah. But I think what we observed in this review, again, was also that dry needling was the most common therapeutic strategy to address the trigger point trigger points, especially around the knee and also in hip, and the patients that benefit the most when assessing the symptoms on the knee, the patients that receive trigger point treatment and dry needling and on active trigger points were the patients that benefit the most in terms of the symptoms of the knee and hip osteoarthritis. So not only measuring the local trigger point pain symptom, but measuring or the knee and hip osteoarthritis, which reflected in an increased range of motion, which we see in clinical practice, but also in terms of painful symptoms. So the knee and hip symptoms were also the benefit from addressing a trigger point in a local or like a very close related tissue, such as quadriceps and hamstrings. So in terms of clinical practice, this can be informative. So whenever you see a patient with, for example, hip and knee osteoarthritis, have a look as well on myofascial trigger points, for example, especially in quads and hams, and address them, and also have a follow-up from these patients in terms of symptom improvement in their knee and hip osteoarthritis. This can be an adjacent strategy to manage these symptoms in these patients.
Yeah, great. And, you know, kind of bring us back to full circle to bring some of the manual therapy back in. It makes me think, okay, you know, there's probably a lot of, shared features between the myofascial pain syndrome and osteoarthritis. I'm assuming inflammation is a big, you know, one that would join the two together, maybe some hypersensitivity and a bunch of other things. But it makes me think of the manual therapy discussion with the rats at the beginning of mm-hmm. our discussion and how you just even working on the lumbar spine there changed some of the more distal components at the knee. And so you were just talking about the knee and the acupuncture there, or the, not the acupuncture, but the dry needling. So,
well, yeah, I meant dry needling, but acupuncture
kind sure,
of
sure.
in the same line of
yeah.
treatment strategy.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Well, that's great. I think you answered all the questions I had just from that discussion there. So awesome. Well, I don't want to end quite yet because I always like to ask my guests if they could just offer any advice to aspiring chiropractors or students who may wish to become a scientist like yourself. You know, what advice you might have for them going forward in pursuing research careers?
No, thanks very much, Dean, for this opportunity, first of all. I always tell my students and also other like friends and so on that I think our field we need to increase research capacity. That's for sure in a chiropractic field, in chiropractic care. It could be in a public health system, could be in epidemiology research, could be in neuroimaging research, could be in only imaging research, but also basic science research. We are only a few, and obviously we cannot change the world alone. So we need more people, we need more research capacity. And I think the field, the scientific or like all medical professions right now are relying on scientific evidence. So this is a great timing for everyone to join this task force, let's say. I'm going to put it that way. I think being in a clinical practice is amazing. It's a fantastic opportunity to help the others and help your patients and etc. Keeping yourselves on top of research and the evidence is great, so you can also talk to other professions as well in a great level. But for new and young students who are perhaps considering research in the future, my word would be do it. Just be curious. Just follow your dream. Don't give up even when the others tell, oh, this is bullshit. It's not worth it. So don't give up. Okay. And keep going. Have some experience in clinical practice, which is very important. But also if you can blend that with a research and doing a master's degree or eventually a PhD, that's an incredible achievement for yourselves and for the profession as well. So either being in a basic science or in a public health, I think we need to advocate for to increase the research capacity, first of all. Yeah, that's and curious and having been curious, questioning the evidence, questioning even like not my evidence, but everybody else's evidence, and eventually learning from other fields as well. I gave an example in this conversation today that I'm also learning from sports science and physical activity and how I am bringing and how those science that were done like let's say 20, 25 years ago are informing me today to bring this to a manual therapy and apply this in manual therapy. So learning other fields are also important as well.
Great. Well, Dr. Duart, that's some great advice, and I really appreciate you coming on the podcast and sharing the great research that you've done, and you're so passionate about talking about your studies, and I know chiropractors and other practitioners, whether it be physical therapy or just anybody who's curious in these kinds of concepts are going to be interested in hearing you discuss these things today. So thank you so much.
Well, thank you, Dean, first of all, for this great opportunity. I think everybody who does a science in manual therapy or a physical therapy, I think it has this kind of dream perhaps to be participating in our podcast. And thank you so much for advocating for and putting this podcast for this long time. And I'm looking forward to seeing and listening your next podcasts as well. And thanks very much for having me, Dean.
Well, thanks so much for those kind words. Take care.
Thank you.